From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In 2001, electric utilities suffered price spikes and blackouts, struggling airlines canceled service, and the overbuilt telecommunications industry tanked. Then Enron imploded. Does deregulation still work? Is it time to go the other way? This hour, we're talking with the father of airline deregulation, Alfred Kahn, about the future of the free market in America. Begin with the latest in Salt Lake City on the figure skating imbroglio. The International Olympic Committee today awarded a second gold medal to Canadian skaters Jamie Salais and David Pelletier after the skating union charged judging misconduct. Helene Elliott is covering the Winter Games for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her how significant this decision is.
It's huge. I mean, it is not unprecedented. There are a few incidents where athletes being awarded gold later and medal standings being changed, but never for this reason. It's always been other reasons. One was because of mechanical error in a judge entering a score for a Canadian synchronized swimmer named Sylvie Frechette in 1992. But this is the first time that it's been done because of any suggestion of corruption among the judging. And I think it's absolutely astounding in the sense that just about every sport, professional, amateur, or otherwise, is founded on the basis of the officials being impartial. And if you have an instance where an official is not impartial, and an official breaches the rules of the governing body of the sport that official is officiating, how can you trust anything after this?
Has there been any response from the French judge who was suspended?
She signed a statement to which we have not yet been privy. She obviously acknowledged some kind of impropriety, whether it was what we think or it's absolutely not clear at this point, but obviously she is suspended, and I'm curious to see not only the length of her suspension, but what the International Skating Union does as a follow-up to this to ensure that it doesn't happen again.
Have there ever been two gold medals awarded for a single event before?
Yes, in 1992 in synchronized swimming, a Canadian swimmer named Sylvie Frechette was the victim of an error by a judge who hit the wrong key on a computer entering a score. And the judge was very clear about it later, saying, I meant to hit key X, and
right.
I said I hit key Y. This is not correct. We must remedy this. And the winner of the event, a woman named Kristen Babb from the U.S., kept her medal, and a second gold medal was awarded to Sylvie Frechette.
What was the thing that you think turned this? Was it outrage within the Olympic Committee over the fact that there may have been corruption in the judging, or was it public outrage that the Olympic Committee wanted to put an end to so the Olympics could go on?
I think public opinion played a very large role in this. This was turning into a Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan media feeding frenzy, and it was threatening to devour the entire Olympic Games and obscure everything that all these people worked years to organize and obscure everything that all these other wonderful athletes have worked years to accomplish. And I think Jacques Rogge, the president of the International Olympic Committee, deserves an enormous amount of credit for stepping in and saying, we've got to get this resolved, we've got to get this resolved quickly, and we've got to get this resolved satisfactorily in order to preserve the image of the Games and in order to restore any kind of faith in fairness and justice.
If public outrage can change the outcome of an Olympic event, of a decision, are we going to see popular judging of Olympic ice skating in the future?
I don't think that's the point. I think the point is that the outrage is that a judge was influenced to vote in a certain way. That's the outrage. You can stand there and debate the merits of the Canadian couples program against the merits of the Russian couples program, and you'll get people who will say that one was better than the other. Yes, the next person, and the answer will be the exact opposite. The point here is that there was allegations of impropriety by a judge. That's the outrage. We have very few illusions left in sport anymore. I mean, everybody knows that the so-called amateur athletes in the Olympics aren't really amateurs anymore, but you have to be able to hold on to a shred of belief that at least the officials are being impartial and that the officials are going to give you a fair shake when you go out there for your six-minute performance or however long a performance it is. And if you can't have that as a foundation, then there's nothing.
Do you think that this dramatic step taken today will change the quality of judging in the future at the Olympics?
That's a tough one. I think there needs to be reforms in the way the judges are chosen for these events, in the sense that there's no reason to do this 3 months in advance. because giving that much advance notice, I think, is temptation for things like deal-making and for outsiders to pressure the judges into doing things. I think the less advance notice, the better, and the fewer the opportunities for something to go amiss.
Any statements after the new gold was awarded from either the Canadians or the Russian skaters?
Well, obviously the Canadians were happy. They considered that justice was done, but I thought they were very gracious in saying that they felt bad for the Russian couple, that they certainly did not mean this in any way to take anything away from what the Russians had done. And this was not a statement of you know, saying that the Russians were not good or anything like that, but it was a statement that there has to be fairness in sports.
Can you feel a sense of relief in Salt Lake City that the games can now go forward with this cloud taken away?
You betcha.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Okay, sure.
Helene Elliott is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me earlier today from Salt Lake City. In the 1970s, under the Carter administration, Alfred Kahn headed the government agency that regulated the U.S. air travel industry. He promptly set out to deregulate air travel and put himself out of a job. Even today, the 84-year-old Kahn remains a staunch defender of deregulation. He says the best thing regulators can do after establishing terms for competition is get out of the way. But in recent months, after the California energy crisis and the Enron scandal, it's regulators that again have Washington's ear and, more importantly, the public's attention. What's happened to the promise of deregulation? It was supposed to spur innovation, lower prices, and work for the benefit of the consumer. Now that the electric utilities, airlines, and telecommunications industries have hit rough economic waters and Enron's looking out of control, is it time to take a look at re-regulation? Is market-driven America rethinking the unfettered market? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from Ithaca, New York, is Alfred Kahn, Professor Emeritus of Political Economy at Cornell University. He's author of many definitive works on regulatory issues and a special consultant to the National Economic Research Associates. He's also known as the father of deregulation. Good evening and a very warm welcome, Alfred Kahn.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. So, Alfred Kahn, you are the father of deregulation in the airline industry, and that moniker has spread a little further than that. So Pops, how's it going? What's the state of deregulation? And I guess the key question is, do you feel a climate change around regulation and deregulation today?
Well, there's no question that these movements are subject to political fashions, and mm-hmm. surely there was a climate change in the 70s and 60s as well, and there's a climate change now. But I think what's important for people who study these matters is to differentiate and not to either say you must be for government regulation or you must be against government regulation. And there are some people who say government can do no good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's asinine. Social Security is a great success. It's practically eliminated poverty among old people. Unemployment insurance, we didn't have that until we introduced a kind of regulation. And it has done very, very good things, except, of course, that it is inadequate. Mm-hmm. And what we need there is more Social Security, at least when the economy goes into a recession.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't make sense to be for government or against government. Mm-hmm. The critical thing is, will the market work well if unregulated, and in what respects will it, and what respects won't it? And where it won't, we never deregulated airline safety, for
mm-hmm.
example,
mm-hmm.
Under the theory that if somebody got on a plane and it crashed and he died, that he'd know better next time. I mean,
people deserve to be as safe as they can be.
Absolutely. So it's always a mixed bag, but I'm enthusiastic about deregulation where it has worked well, and I believe that it has worked very well in airlines, and I'm waiting for you to tell me all the respects in which you think it is not.
Well, we're going to challenge that, but you do grant then that there's a change in the air. As you say, that the needle swings from pro-regulation to anti-regulation. There's always a changing political climate, and right now that change seems to be even
even broader than strict issues of regulation and deregulation. The whole notion of the wide open freedom of the market that was so celebrated in the 80s and 90s seems to have led to a climate that led to abuses in Enron's case and maybe in other corporations as well. Do you see even a kind of a nimbus around the regulatory issue of a larger question in the American public's mind about how free the markets become?
Yeah, there's no question about that. And where it appears that we've deregulated and competition, for whatever reason, has not worked well. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the SNL. Terrible fiasco. Yeah. Those billions of dollars of losses.
Nightmare of the
80s. We deregulated them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we retained deposit insurance so that they could just attract more deposits by offering higher and higher interest rates without worry about what they invested in. They could invest in highly speculative loans, but the people from whom they borrowed would always get the money protected from by the government. Mm-hmm. So you may have to learn that if you let go entirely, you may make things worse, especially if you retain, in this case, government deposit insurance. Mm-hmm. You can't be for it or against it. It's simply ridiculous to say we're against free trade internationally. Mm-hmm. There's no question that the opening up of world markets has, in those countries that have exposed themselves to world trade and investment, has markedly reduced poverty. Mm-hmm. The countries that have remained totally mired in poverty are the countries that have insulated themselves from the rest of the world and typically have corrupt governments and waste all the resources on war. You just can't say I'm in favor of regulation or I'm opposed to regulation.
Well, we'll grant you that. But at that very high level, Alfred Kahn, do you personally have the feeling that somehow we moved too far into unfettered market territory by the end of the 90s or not?
Well, I think in the case of electricity, there was an element of important element of opportunism. There are people who saw that the companies had very expensive excess capacity, and it looked as though the prices were being held up in order to cover the costs of those excessive investments. Mm. And people said, well, supply is so far ahead of demand, let's deregulate because now we'll screw these companies, we'll make them compete, and we'll get great gains. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a certain irony in that the very time when they did it, the supply-demand situation was turning around. And in fact, look at California as the extreme. Supply became very short. Demand grew very unexpectedly. And when you let go, prices soared instead of the reverse. There's a certain poetic justice in that case. That does not mean that a sensible deregulation of electricity will not work and that we can't learn from these mistakes.
Could there be such a thing as a re-regulatory ice age, a political response to problems of late that would pull the American economy back toward a heavier hand of government?
Of course there could. You can have rational political movements. You can have irrational political movements. I have not yet seen people say, well, we should abandon environmental protection because the deregulation has not worked well elsewhere. The fact is we have cleaner water, cleaner air than we had 40, 50, and 100 years ago. You can swim in Lake Erie, whereas it used to be that Lake Erie would be on fire because of all the oil that was on its surface. People swim in the Thames. They couldn't swim in the Thames. So it's insane to adopt it across the board. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
You're attributing those cleaner waters to regulation, to environmental regulation.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It would not pay anybody to control the effluents, to put in scrubbers to prevent the sulfur oxide emissions, or to require a limitation on the particulates because that would increase costs. By shifting the cost to society, the cost of poorer health, the cost of having to paint your homes more. Mm-hmm. So there's no question that a free market doesn't work well where people can shift the costs onto other people. So that regulation, if anything, the evidence is clearly that we have to do more of that. It appears more and more people feel that global warming is really a danger. That's going to call for regulation because it doesn't pay individuals to control their emissions if other people don't control their emissions.
Alfred Kahn giving us the high word on regulation, deregulation, and the market in the year 2002. There's a shift going on out there. We're trying to get a beat on it tonight. What do you think? Has deregulation worked for you in air travel, in phone service, in life? Has the market-driven life made you a happier man, a happier woman? Is the tide turning? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the market, in some sense, about regulation and deregulation, about whether the market forces loose in the American economy have gotten a little bit too loose in recent years. What do you think? Have you had enough of the Wild West free market era, or are you still a believer that the unregulated market will float your boat? Does Enron tell you things are out of hand? Are you ready to re-regulate America? We're joined tonight by Alfred Kahn. He's professor of emeritus of political economy at Cornell University, well known as the father of deregulation of the airline industry. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Alfred Kahn, all right, the bill of particulars on deregulation. People say electric utilities, we've got capacity shortages and price spikes and scattered blackouts. Airlines, we've got canceled flights and planes put into desert storage and mayhem in the airline terminals. Telephone services sector, investment cut so dramatically that it helped drag down the entire U.S. economy. Is deregulation responsible for this Sherman's March to the Sea here?
Look, I'm not an expert on what makes people happy and what makes people unhappy.
Okay.
But it may well be that we'd all be happier if we were all poorer and there was no envy and everybody was equally treated.
Well, we wonder.
It's possible. We may be just running fast as possible to stand in place. But look at the reactions of people. When discount fares became available in profusion.
Joy.
Boy, did people react. Did people travel? College kids go back and visit their families. Mm-hmm. Children visit their parents. So we know from the behavior of consumers that the availability of discount tickets has led to an explosion in flying.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's enough for me. I'm not going to tell them it's good for them to fly or not to fly. But last year, something like 96% of all mileage was at discount fares. And the average discount was 96%. The average discount.
It's hard to argue with that.
That's right. Now, look at long-distance phoning. It depends on how old you are.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you remember when there was a long-distance call and people would say to everybody in the family, shh, be quiet. It's a long-distance call.
I remember it well. And keep it
short.
Make
it short.
Right.
Make it short. That's exactly right. Well, now I use long-distance like water.
Mm.
And look at something that's beyond me, which is cellular telephones. Unfortunately, I'm 84 years old, so I don't react as quickly as others. But cellular telephone business has exploded even more in the rest of the world. And we've got to admit that it's a source of convenience and safety. And it's because it has been competitive. It was deregulated. And we have now 5 or 6 or 7 competing cellular phone companies in each locality.
But is there such a thing as these wonderful benefits being outweighed by the static that comes along? We've all been driven crazy by the way airline travel seems to be so botched lately, and that's even right before September 11th. On the telephone front, the way service is patchy, intermittent, and now we hear that it's falling back into the hands of just a few baby bells again, as if Ma Bell were back. The utilities problems in California we all saw. Is there such a thing as, sure, we applaud the good side of deregulation, but could it be argued it's gone too far, or is somehow this just trouble on the way to paradise?
It's all three. But again, it's necessary to be discriminating.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the Enron fiasco. Now, I'm not an expert on Enron.
All right.
But it's no question that deregulation of electric markets created opportunities for trading that these people engaged in. It is desirable if you have a free market that you do have the ability of people to hedge and speculators to come in and say, well, we'll protect you. We'll sell you a contract over the next year and guarantee that your rates will not fluctuate and we'll bear the risk.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that you can permit people to be crooks. I know only what I read in the papers, and with disgust, I don't read it very much.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly looks as though there were terrible abusive practices at the expense of investors, insider trading, screwing workers. That's a technical economic term.
Yes.
By limiting their investment to Enron stock. Those were terrible, vile things to do.
But it looks like sometimes it looks like part of the package, Alfred Kahn, that if you get yourself in this wide open, anything goes mood that comes with deregulation, that people are going to also be hurt. Is that necessary?
It is often an accompaniment, and that means you have to be discriminating. What you have to do is look at the securities markets, where in the 20s there were these terrible examples of manipulation by insiders, as well as more recently. Well, you've got to have cops. You do have to regulate. A free market will not operate unless you have very stern rules about it. And it looks as though the SEC, Securities Exchange Commission, which is a regulation introduced to cure some of the awful manipulations of the 1920s, was not doing its job. Mm-hmm. We set up auditors. It's a kind of a protection. Well, it looks as though the auditors had vile conflicts of interest. Well, so, yes, you do have to regulate to see that markets work well, but that doesn't mean that you want to prevent competition.
So, but when you, the father of deregulation, look out on America 2002, does it feel like vandals have gotten into the temple here a little bit, or is this just the rough and tumble that comes with the markets that we need to keep things vigorous?
We always have to beware of vandals in free markets. But please be sure that if we had a nationalized system or a socialized system, that would not protect you against vandals. Mm-hmm. It would not make political corruption less important. It would make political corruption more important. So we still have to have protections, weak as they may be, strengthen protections against political corruption. Take the case, this is a significant one. Airfares have gone down more than 40% on average if adjusted for inflation.
Okay.
And the estimates of Brookings are that travelers have saved something like $19 billion a year. At the same time, there's no question that air travel has become less comfortable, more congested, and there's no question about that. Well, in a sense, that's success. Because under regulation...
How did I miss that?
Well...
It didn't feel so perfectly successful sometimes, Alfred Kahn.
Well, it takes an economist to tell you why. Under regulation, you had uniformly high fares. Mm-hmm. It was a crime to engage in price cutting. The result was you had very good service. Planes were on average 50% full. Mm-hmm. You had an empty seat next to you. Lines were short. Service was good. What the market lacked was the competition that would give people much cheaper fares with correspondingly lower quality service. Not just the Cadillac, but the Volkswagen.
Well, that's the package that we're buying here. Much cheaper fares and no 6-seat stretch to lay down in on the way to L.A.
Absolutely. We've given people that option. At the same time, the airlines are trying more and more to see if they can have better service for the people who pay the full fares. Until recently, whenever I traveled, because I traveled a lot, I would get upgraded to first class. Mm-hmm. I get on separate lines when the others serpentine lines are all over the floor of the concourse. I get on a separate line because I'm a frequent traveler.
That's why you love deregulation.
and point of fact, I ceased to get that benefit because the airlines are in such terrible financial trouble.
Alfred Kahn, the next time I'm flying to L.A. with my knees up under my chin, no lunch served, and every seat on the plane full, I'm going to think of all the beautiful economic benefits that I'm enjoying.
Think of all the money you're saving so you can have a really good meal when you get off.
I guess I'll have to do that. Father of deregulation, you're very popular. There are a lot of folks who want to join our conversation. Let's bring them in. Andrew is on the line.
Course.
Welcome, Andrew. You're on the air.
Good evening. I actually have a real quick comment. I study a lot on kind of how airline labor relations work and how actually aviation safety works.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that deregulations have kind of a double-edged sword effect on the airline industry.
How so?
It's had a very positive effect on airline safety, and I definitely agree, because if you look at the Air Florida Flight 90 out of Washington, I think that was 1980 when they the bridge in the Potomac,
mm-hmm.
that brought about significant changes that didn't require FAA intervention, namely what's known as cockpit resource management.
Okay.
And that's definitely a triumph that, FAA didn't have to spend 6 years drafting regulation and going through its very slow process. But you have companies like AMR Group, which owns American Airlines, now also owns TWA, and also owns American Eagle, which has become very effective with what's known as whipsawing. It's taking its different labor unions of all its different little acquired airlines and making them fight for each other to get the lowest fares out so they come out on top.
Mm. Andrew, we've got it. I want to put that to Alfred Kahn. Alfred Kahn, Andrew says, we're lucky. We're no longer face down in the Potomac, but labor is getting whipsawed. How about that?
Well, I'm sorry that that is a difficult story. There's no question that wages under regulation were far above what they would have otherwise been. There's just no doubt about that. I want to have a good pilot in the cockpit. I want to be sure he's trained and responsible, and I'm indebted to them when they are trained and responsible. But pilots' pay in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year was partly possible because the industry was not competitive. And it is perfectly true that some of the effective new competitors are able to offer low fares because they're offering very low wages. And to some extent, that frightens me, too.
Possible that we get the theoretically beautiful benefits of deregulation and we get that cheaper fare, but we end up somehow living in a dog-eat-dog, whipsaw, low-wage economy where we're all theoretically doing great, but we don't feel so great?
Well, it may well be that the flight attendants do have a legitimate grievance, but I believe that anybody who looks at comparative wages in the airline industry and in other in competitive industries will recognize the strength of the unions. Now, look, I don't know all of details of the argument between the machinists and United. Mm-hmm. And I recognize they say that they haven't had a wage increase since 1993. Mm-hmm. So I can understand the difficulty. But this is a worker-owned airline. It is losing money hand over fist. It's like U.S. Air, which is losing money just terribly, and its future was threatened. Mm-hmm. There's no question. Labor costs are 35% of the total cost. Mm-hmm. So competition does work both ways.
We got the issue, and we're living with it, some of us more directly than others.
Right.
Alfred Kahn, please stand by. We're joined now by Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Good evening and welcome, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much for being with us. Dean Baker, there's this new concern. We're just talking about it with Alfred Kahn that maybe somehow the free market has become too free. What's Washington considering now to pull in the reins post bubble burst, post stock market scandals, post Enron? What's on the table?
Well, I think there is a new consideration to this environment deregulation. I'd pick up on what Alfred Kahn said earlier, that it can go too far. You can have excesses. And I think the bottom line here is that you want to think about deregulation in a very practical way. What are you hoping to accomplish by it? And do it out of a pragmatic sense rather than out of ideology. And certainly some of the areas of deregulation, like the deregulation of the utilities, the electricity in California or in Oregon, they proved to be disasters because, people seem to be pursuing that as an end in itself. And I think there is a recognition that you do need the cops in there. You do need regulation. We want smart regulation. There is plenty to complain about of the regulation that Alfred Kahn did so much to change or eliminate it back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But, that doesn't mean you just go home and just say, do whatever you feel like.
Well, now that's an interesting question. Dean Baker, let's put that to Alfred Kahn. Alfred Kahn, do you agree? Is it all about pragmatic deregulation, not ideological deregulation? Or if we really want to be economically successful, do we have to commit to an ideology of deregulation?
I agree totally. A plague on ideologues on both sides. I do think you have to look pragmatically at what the possibilities are.
But you're an icon of these ideologues who are against regulation. How can you be plaguing them?
Well, it's wonderful for me because I consider myself a liberal Democrat, and yet Republicans and conservatives are very hesitant about criticizing me because I did so much to deregulate.
Mm-hmm.
But I am pragmatic in the sense that I think you cannot just say take everything out of the way. In the electric industry particularly, there are elements of the electric industry that are absolutely unique. It's the only industry I know in which when somebody flicks on a switch, you expect instantaneously that the power will flow.
You're darn right.
It's the only, and it's the only industry in which you have the absolute need for a complete integration between transportation, transmission, mm-hmm. which is sort of a natural monopoly, mm-hmm. and generation, which could well be competitive. Mm-hmm. But you damn well better be sure you're doing it carefully. And though I think California thought it was doing carefully, it made some terrible mistakes from which we can learn. And you've had nothing like that kind of problem in the Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland pool, or even in the New York deregulation. Mm-hmm. And it keeps me occupied. I keep writing now about what went wrong in California and how we can correct it.
Well, Dean Baker, look over the horizon with us here at the landscape of changes that may be coming. Post Enron, this is a hot issue, and people just aren't willing to put up with it anymore. Whatever it is, it's hard to define. Where do you see an urge toward a more conservative approach, more government intervention, more oversight?
Certainly in finance. I think it's clear, you know, we had the Glass-Steagall regulation that was depreciation regulation of the banks that, you know, had all sorts of restrictions, a lot of which no longer made sense. But I think we've clearly gone the other way, and some of this is behind the Enron story, that you had people dealing with complex financial instruments. They had no idea what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
You have a big risk that, I mean, part of the basic story with banking regulations that you have an insured system, the government backs up bank deposits. You don't want that flowing over into sort of the equity system where you're having the government insuring risky ventures.
So what about the banking system, Glass-Steagall? Are we going to bring back the separation of lending and investment banking?
Well, in principle, there are supposed to be walls, and I think the question will be how do you ensure that there are walls that are serious that can't be gotten around? And there's not an easy answer to that, but I think we all recognize that there have to be serious walls. You can't have a situation where someone's lending money to a company that they have an equity interest in protecting.
Mm-hmm. So the shares market, you see more regulation or oversight coming in there. Accounting, surely there's going to be more regulation
surely
there.
Surely accounting. I mean, this was just incredible because what you have here, the basic logic, and if you talk to people in the industry, they tell you this is going on for a long time, the companies hire the accountants. Well, you have an accountant that says, you know, your books are misleading in your books. You go, the company says, I'll get a new accountant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the accountants are smart people. They go, okay, what do you want us to show? And when you have that, you know, you just, you know, the markets, they have to have honest information. And if you have accountants that are just going to go in there and do whatever's convenient for the company, then the whole thing falls apart. And this is really fundamental for the sort of market economy we have. So you need some serious regulation there.
And how about
how can I disagree with anybody whose name begins with Dean?
there's a lifelong academic speaking. Litigation curbs, Dean Baker. Are companies going to be more vulnerable to shareholder suits if they screw up?
I think we might see, again, some reversal there. I mean, recently the laws made it very difficult to sue companies for failure to disclose accurate information or disclosing misleading information. I think we might see some changes there because I think clearly the laws went too far in the last few years in the other direction.
And the overall atmosphere, are you persuaded that the needle is going to move back toward a more conservative, less free market climate in the United States, or are we just too far into the game for that?
Well, I think we're going to – I'm a little hesitant to use the word free market or not free market because I think it really is a question of how you think about it. I mean, is it a free market if we have people issuing shares and just putting down whatever they want as their profits? I mean, to have a working market system, you have to know that, you know, if IBM tells you they made $1 billion last quarter, that's actually what they did.
Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Dean Baker, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Listeners, we're talking with Alfred Kahn, Professor Emeritus of Political Economy at Cornell University, the father of deregulation, about where America stands in relation to regulation, deregulation, free and less free markets right now. Would you welcome the return of a firmer government hand over business, or would you fear suffocation of the great American economy? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Join us. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about regulation, deregulation, and the market uber alles with the father of American deregulation, Alfred Kahn. What do you think? Has the market-driven life made you a happier man, a happier woman? Alfred Kahn, we have a lot of calls. We're going to have to discipline ourselves to talk to these people now. Let's turn there. Mark is on the line. Welcome, Mark. You're on the air. Hello, Mark.
How are you?
Hi, we're well, thank you.
So
my position is I think that the market is, especially the equity market, is very well regulated, if not over-regulated. And I'll just give you my personal perspective on this.
Okay.
I'm a software engineer.
Yep.
I'm working in the telecom industry, and I've been working in the telecom industry for a little over 10 years. And I had the good fortunes of joining a startup company in early 1999. The company went public in 2000, and myself, having incentive stock options, saw my personal wealth, on paper at least, go up significantly. And I mean, it was a lot of money. I was very excited. But the fact of the matter is, SEC regulations prevented me from selling a single share. I couldn't do anything except watch the value of my stock go from about 170 to about 30 or to the low 20s before I could sell.
You had it right there in your hands, Mark. So where do you end up feeling here? Is this too much regulation or not enough?
Well, to add insult to injury, myself and thousands of other taxpayers who suddenly found themselves with stock options still had to cough up tax on the paper value at the end of the year.
So are you saying you don't want the SEC oversight? You don't want the lockup on your stocks? You just want to sell them whenever you please?
Well, I think that if you take a look at what happened to Enron, I think it's being blown a little bit out of proportion to make it look like this is something that is industry-wide. This could be happening at any company. When I think what you really got to keep in perspective here is that to a large extent, the boom of the 90s did bring a lot of wealth and prosperity to a lot of people. There were real companies with real products out there, but these are a few bad apples. And it's no question what Ken Lay and the executives at Enron did was wrong, and the rank-and-file employees suffered.
Mark, we got it. Thanks for your call. Alfred Kahn, we hear in Mark someone who almost struck it rich in the volatility on the upside of his deregulated market, but then he saw the big downside. And there's a lot of talk about the boom and bust cycle of increasing returns industries like the telecoms industries. Is this an inevitable part of a deregulated market that people like Mark are going to end up frustrated sometimes because, hey, that big stock price goes away when the bust comes?
Well, let me just two very brief comments. One, when you have free markets buying and selling claims on companies and claims on future earnings, there's going to be speculation. There's no question about it. Mm-hmm. That means some people are going to make a lot of money, and some people who thought they were very rich will discover they're very poor. Mm-hmm. I don't know the specific SEC regulations that he's talking about, but clearly when you have the privilege of limited liability, you go into a stock market and your liability is limited to what's in that company. Mm-hmm. You've got to have protections from investors against insiders misusing the information. Mm-hmm. Whether these rules were excessively stringent or not, I don't know. Whether you suffered mainly just because it was a tulip mania or a land boom mania, such as we've had in the past, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you believe that you should not have regulations to protect people, innocent investors who may be subject to abuse by people who have inside knowledge and, in effect, steal from them.
That's a regulation most people would accept. Dana is on the line. Welcome, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening to both of you.
Good evening.
I think the idea of free markets and without the interference of government, the so-called interference of government, is cynical rhetoric that American business uses to wrest control and, you know, from the government, which is, hello, us, American people.
But the economy is also us, the American people, isn't it, Dana? Where exactly is the cynicism?
Well, I mean, you know, because that way they don't have to, they wouldn't, if it wasn't for government, they wouldn't have to acknowledge unions, they wouldn't have to enforce safety in the workplace, there would be no minimum wage. Government does a lot of other things like protect beautiful open wilderness from business exploitation development.
So do you feel you need to see more regulation in the American economy, Dana?
Yes, especially in the telecommunications industry and
well, you don't like those low long-distance charges?
Well, I don't know at the price we have to pay for them, no, especially with the cell phone industry. But I have another point to make. I mean, I could go into that, but I told your screener I had another point. And I'd like to say that a lot of these businesses that complain about, especially in the West, cattle ranches I'd like to pick on, that cry about big government on our backs, a lot of them are grazing their cattle at bargain basement prices on federal lands.
Mm-hmm. Dana, thanks for that. I want to put it to Alfred. Let's just go to that phrase, big government on our backs. That's a kind of archetypal 90s phrase and complaint, Alfred Kahn. Do you think, can you say generally whether or not it's fair these days for any part of American business to talk about bigger government on its back?
Well, let me just give you two examples. Mm-hmm. The example of the cattle industry. I couldn't agree with you more. Of course you're right. That's a case in which government is using, the businesses' interests with strong political power mm-hmm. are using the government
in the public domain.
In effect, to subsidize them.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another second fact that you should think about. Who was opposed to airline deregulation? It was the airlines. There was only one airline that was in favor of deregulation.
They wanted to be on the cushy inside of the regulatory circle.
And be protected.
Mm-hmm.
In the trucking industry, we deregulated trucking. Who was our main opponent? The trucking industry.
Mm-hmm.
So there are cases in which businesses use government to protect them from competition.
Alfred Kahn, let's get one more call if we can. Our time's about
up. Rashid
is on the line. Welcome, Rashid.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hello, everyone. I've been hearing your debate being posed as a one between regulation and deregulation
mm-hmm.
or non-regulation,
mm-hmm.
and I think that it's really important not to be constricted with this with this proposition.
How would you frame it, Rashid?
Well, why is it that we should the people, the community
mm-hmm.
should allow these corporations, these profiteers, to have as much freedom as possible to exploit us at our own expense, and then just impose some sort of regulation to control that from going beyond what would be seemly.
What's the alternative, Rashid?
Well, if the community is actually in control in a true democracy, you wouldn't need a few people in Washington making regulations to regulate these multinational corporations, where the communities, the people themselves, would actually be in control in a direct democracy, and.
It's an interesting point. Alfred Kahn, Rashid is kind of saying it's either democracy or open market capitalism, and we have to choose. Do you buy that, Alfred Kahn?
Well, I think that it's so simplistic.
Mm-hmm.
You have to talk about specific instances. And remember, there are instances in which governments do use, big business interests do use the government to enable them to exploit, to have power, to at the expense of the public.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there's no question that the automobile companies were suffering from the competition of Japanese cars, which were much better in quality than theirs and lower price.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted the government to protect them from the competition. That was a case in which deregulation was the proper thing, and I was proud that President Carter refused to put limitations on Japanese cars.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, these overarching generalizations are insufficient. You have to look at the particular case and try to help yourself decide where does the public interest lie.
Alfred Kahn, we've only got a few seconds left. Are you optimistic about the future of the American economy and the flight path it's on?
Yes, I am. Of course, I'm worried about corruption of the political process, but I think we simply have – there's no substitute for an enlightened citizenry that asks what is good for the public, and that is not always more government intervention, and it is not always no government intervention.
Alfred Kahn, Professor Emeritus of Political Economy at Cornell University, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
I enjoyed it. Bye.
For more on the issues surrounding deregulation, visit our website, onpointradio.org. Five months after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, many Americans are still looking for answers. This week, the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard hosted a forum titled September 11th, How Did This Happen? Where Do We Go From Here? Joseph Nye, the dean of the Kennedy School, and Brian Michael Jenkins, a senior advisor to the president of the think tank RAND, each shared their views on whether the attacks on New York and Washington were the result of an intelligence failure. Tonight, we're airing their comments. First, Joseph Nye, Jr.
If you define an intelligence failure as failing to collect information and use it to protect the American people, then by definition, what happened on 9/11 was an intelligence failure. If you define it more narrowly as failure to make use adequately of information that's already inside the system, it may or may not be an intelligence failure. Should we have seen it coming? A lot of people saw it coming. In early 94, we did a study which looked at both the prospects of biological and nuclear terrorism. In 95, we had two things that happened. One was the Amshin Rikyo attack in the Tokyo subway system. And we also had our own purely homegrown Tim McVeigh. So it's very important not to think of terrorism simply as Islamic or growing out of this. I mean, there is a real problem with al-Qaeda and that source of terrorism. But let me raise this in a way which may, I hope, provoke Brian a little bit. When we did this study in 94, we said there are two new things which should put this on the top of the government's agenda. One is a new type of terrorist, and the other is new access to weapons that can do enormous catastrophic damage. There's a diffusion of technology which is putting in the hands of deviant groups and individuals capacities that used to be reserved just to governments. If you wanted to kill 1 million people in the past, you pretty much had to be a Stalin or a Mao. If you want to kill 1 million people in 2010, you can probably do it as a small group. And if you look at the progression of terrorism, which has been with us for centuries, it usually killed people in ones and twos. You know, then you get the 70s, the Red Brigades and so forth, maybe killing in the tens. In the 1980s, with the Air India attack of 350 or so killed, you're in the hundreds. By 2001, you're in the thousands. And we ought to ask ourselves, by 2010, do you think we will have seen a terrorist attack which goes up yet another order of magnitude and kills hundreds of thousands or millions? I think the answer to that is likely to be yes. I think the question is, why did we lull ourselves so? And if we look at what happened in the 1990s when the Cold War ends, we just stopped paying attention. Americans still say they're interested in international things, but we weren't. We were indifferent to the rest of the world. And we thought we were invincible and invulnerable. That's a huge failure of intelligence on a much broader scale than the intelligence community.
Brian, what do you think about the intelligence failure question?
Clearly, intelligence failed in that we were not able to either obtain the information or to exploit the information we had. The question to me really is, was that a reflection of how difficult it is simply to obtain information about terrorist organizations, or is it some systemic failure in the way we, in this country, organizationally go about the collection and analysis of intelligence? You know, if we look at the history, for example, of the United Kingdom in dealing with the IRA, this was somebody that was closer to them geographically, culturally. They had the language capabilities, and to be sure, there was a degree of penetration. But nonetheless, large-scale terrorist events took place despite the determination of the government. They were onto this, and they were surprised. If one looks at the history of Israel and the efforts of the Mossad and the Shin Bet to deal with terrorism. To be sure, they thwart a lot of terrorist attacks, but they miss a certain number of large-scale events as well. And so we just didn't miss this. A lot of people miss this one. And that says it's hard to do. Now, are there inherent difficulties in the way we do it? There have been arguments made that we need more resources. There have been arguments made that some of the restrictions on recruiting of sources of intelligence have impeded our collection process. There are, I think, some arguments made about the division within the government of intelligence responsibilities and the ability to share that information. Now, despite all of these difficulties, we're probably identifying and thwarting somewhere in the territory of 80 to 90% of major terrorist attacks directed against Americans here or abroad. But if we move into the realm of terrorism that Professor Nye is talking about, 90% isn't going to be good enough if that remaining 10% are at the scale that is potentially on the horizon.
Brian Michael Jenkins, a senior advisor to the president of the think tank RAND, speaking at the Kennedy School of Government earlier this week. We also heard from Kennedy School Dean Joseph Nye, Jr. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.